This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is The Breakfast Grill. In the past, businesses had few options when they had grown to a certain size but needed more capital to be even bigger. It was either borrow from a bank, relatives, or even find your own investors. But today, we have private equity funds with US $3.6 trillion of assets sloshing around globally. So we have with us Tan Chow Yin, partner at Diamond Asia Private Equity based in Singapore, to give us some colour on this alternate asset class, to understand how these professional investors source for deals, help a company grow and finally execute the all-important exit. Welcome, Chow Yin. Now let's start at the very beginning. So how did Diamond Private Equity start?
So we started in 2012 as part of the Diamond Asia Capital family. Diamond Asia Capital is an alternative asset manager. We are predominantly in hedge funds, but we also have now, since 2012, a very important private equity business. When we first started in 2012, we were given some monies to manage. That came up to about 300 million Sing dollars. DAP1 invested in 12 companies since 2012. And since then, we have been able to raise another fund last year. DAP2, which is a $450 million US dollar fund. And to date, we have invested in 5 companies.
Can you tell us what they are currently invested in? Is it some Malaysian listed companies in those funds?
Yeah, so we are focused on Southeast Asia. And within Southeast Asia, we are especially active in Singapore, Malaysia and Thailand, where we have local on-the-ground presence. In Malaysia, we have invested in the water business with Spritzer, the leading bottled water business in Malaysia. We are also in Farmfresh, the leading fresh milk business in Malaysia. We are in Franken, the leading semiconductor services business. And we also have a stake in Atlas Vending, which is the largest number of independent vending machine business in Malaysia. And some of our businesses in Singapore, such as the Select Group, also have a presence in Malaysia.
Okay, and who are the clients of these funds who buy DAP1 or who buy into DAP2?
Very good question. Our investors are predominantly institutional investors. So when we invest money, it's not just our own money that we are putting into the business. About 80% of our investment quantum actually comes from institutional players such as sovereign wealth entities, fund of funds, large multinational banks, as well as insurance companies that have liabilities to service. And also family offices, multi-generational ones.
Because it's not for the ordinary man on the street, right? Because there are some restrictions. I'm sure there is a lockup for these funds. It's not like equity or unit trust funds where you can just redeem overnight. Do these funds also then have a fixed tenure?
Correct. So private equity funds are among the hardest funds to manage because of this so-called locked-up period that you mentioned. So most of our funds, when we raise them, are 5+5. So there's a 5-year commitment period where we can draw the investment when we have investment to make. And then there's another 5 years of realization. And typically, you know, the funds also come with an option of extension. So when an investor writes us a check, they are essentially putting their trust in us to manage their money over a period of 10 to 12 years.
Yes, for the long haul, isn't it, for PE fund investors? So because it's such a long haul, I'm just interested, what kind of returns do you tell investors to expect? Let's say for DAP1, which has been vintage year 2012, right? What do they have in mind at the end of that 12 years? So we're talking about 2024. What kind of returns do you think they'll get? Or what kind of returns do you think they hope to get?
So when investors invest in private equity funds, they're looking for alpha creation. They're looking for us to be able to create additional value beyond, let's say, investing in passive ETF or investing in public bonds or public equities. So for investors, they will typically look for quite a bit of premium, and we are able to deliver that premium because we are actually working within these companies ourselves. We are actually rolling up our sleeves, working side by side with management on specific initiatives. So we will not be able to so-called guarantee some returns to our investors, but typically there will be a high watermark. So your investors only, investor will get a certain return. Typically, that's about, say, 8%. before we ourselves get paid. So investors will look for some premium over the typical public market returns.
The issue about private equity funds is also similar to like any hedge fund, because there is usually a 20% performance fee, right, from profits. So it does mean that you probably have to work much harder, or the funds do need to generate higher returns for the PE investor to actually have a good return. So if we look at Cambridge Associates, which is a leading researcher on PE fund performance, they say that the blended five-year return on PE funds in emerging and developed Asia, which is the market you're in, is about 12.9%. Are you targeting at least that for, let's say, DAP1?
So when we fundraise, that is an index that we pay quite a lot of attention to, the Cambridge index that you just mentioned. So for Fund 1, we are very comfortably above that. In fact, of the 12 investments that we have made, we have already exited 4. And from that 4 exits that we have made, we have more than returned the money that the investors give us. And so we still have another 8 more companies to harvest. The returns are looking very good. I think that is quite fortunate.
Can you tell us what that number is? Is it in the 18% range? Because that's the upper quartile, right, for the group that you're in.
Yeah. So for DAP1, we are comfortably in the quartile one. And when we did our fundraising, you know, these numbers have to be verified as well. So we have been, thankfully so far, able to work hard and deliver on, you know, what we tell our investors.
Meanwhile, the focus at Diamond, right, is very much on companies that are on the in the lower mid-market segment. So we're talking about those that make between US 5 to 30 million a year. Now, why do you specifically look at this range?
So for the lower mid-market, we feel that this is really a sector that is crying out for some form of assistance, whether it's in the form of directional guidance, strategic guidance, whether it's in the form of cross-border acquisitions, whether it's in the form of helping them with digital marketing or helping them with system implementation. This is really the sector that is still quite dominated by entrepreneurs and family-owned businesses. Of course, we do see professional management buyouts as well, which we really like. You know, we want to equitize active managers. So this sector is really the area where we feel there's a lot of very interesting businesses, very interesting companies, and they would welcome some of the value add, some of the work, some of our blood, sweat and tears working alongside with them.
So this isn't driven by the fact that your total fund size is about US 700 million, and which means you don't really compete with the likes of the big boys. So you're like Blackstone, KKR, Carlyle Group, whose fund size are north of 30 billion US. I mean, so you have to kind of play in the smaller pond?
Yeah, that's really by design. That's where our passion lies. That's where we have built our career working. Over the last 15 years, I've really been focusing, and me and my partners actually, we have all been focusing on the lower mid-market sector. So this is a sector that really energizes us. We build a lot of rapport with the entrepreneurs. We understand the sacrifices that they have to make. And we see the potential for their growth, because when you're starting out disrupting an industry from a small base, the scope of growth is much higher than if you were already the dominant industry leader and just eking out some efficiency returns. So for the large funds, I mean, these players are being paid to do big deals, right? And the big deals are typically very intermediated. So the chance of finding alpha with larger deals is probably lower.
But then Bain & Co. notes, right, in their 2019 private equity outlook, that there is this sharp polarization between large funds. So you're talking like KKR or Carlyle Group. They have strong track records and they have been very active in this region. They weren't a few years ago, but they're here in Asia now. Versus the smaller, less experienced funds who maybe are having difficulty raising funds and also exiting. So with 700 million US dollars under assets, you aren't exactly a big boy. So do you think that this is a fair statement from Bain?
Yeah, we don't see ourselves as necessarily big boys, and we don't want to be. We want to be in our own specific segment, which is the mid-market segment. So yeah, I think you're right. We would struggle to describe ourselves as, you know, large funds playing beta rather than alpha and taking part in auctions that are run by intermediaries. of all the deals that we have done, every single one have been bilateral discussions. So we have not been very fortunate when it comes to bidding for deals. We have been much better when we are looking for those deals ourselves and, you know, working hard on the ground to convert the deals.
I want to know how you source and convert these deals, right? Because there are lots of players in town, a lot of PE funds in town, lots of bankers in town. So how do you actually win these deals?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's no longer about finding, right? Because in this era, most good companies would have some kind of a publicity, would have won some awards, would have, you know, engaged bankers for financing. So the companies are quite well known. People do go out and target specific companies that they want to have some, you know, investment exposure. So the challenge is really more around conversion. The challenge is going out there, telling the entrepreneurs what we have done, telling the entrepreneurs this is how we can potentially help them, trying to find whether there's some overlap, where there's some mutual alignment of interest, where they believe what we say, where we have shown the track record and the competencies to do these things. So it's not just us talking. We do have to bring in capabilities. We have to bring in examples, knowledges of certain sectors to get them to engage. And once the engagement starts, it really takes, you know, sometimes a very, very long period of engagement before they finally say yes. I like to tell my investors that, you know, we always have competition. We have competition from wealthy individuals, wealthy family offices. We have competition from IPO. We have competition from other funds. But the most important competitor is, to me, Mr. Do Nothing. You know, the best businesses do not constantly raise funds or do not constantly sell their shares. The best businesses are those that are like what Jim Collins called hedgehogs. You know, they have a constancy of purpose. They keep their head down. They keep doing what they are very good at, right? And sometimes that's the best option. Too much money can be a bad thing, right? Too much money can make you take unnecessary risks. It can cause friction between family members and partners. So yeah, sometimes, you know, we like those entrepreneurs who have a choice of saying no.
You're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Tan Chow Yin, partner of Diamond Asia Private Equity. After we come back, we'll be talking about the value that his group adds to the target company and that all-important exit, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Tan Chow Yin, partner of Diamond Asia Private Equity. Earlier, we talked about the competition and whether there's too much money chasing too few deals, whilst also taking a deeper dive at the fund's performance. Now, Chow Yin, tell us, how does a PE fund help a founder? What do you do that a founder can't do himself?
PE investors, you know, we'll never pretend that we know about the business or the sector more than the entrepreneur. That's impossible. But what we'll bring is, you know, bring a broad range of experience across industries and across countries. And that has a lot of value for entrepreneurs who have only focused their life in one area and one specific company. So we are able to bring to bear learnings from elsewhere. And in our case, for Diamond Asia Private Equity, we have also developed specific technical knowledge in areas of corporate finance, strategy, digital marketing, system implementation, and a lot of them are actually looking for cross-border acquisition support. So that's something that it's much easier for us to bring to bear for the SME or the entrepreneurs than, you know, if they were to do it themselves, it would be, you know, too risky, too long, too arduous.
So it's a combination of financial and operational engineering on your part to improve these companies, right? I would presume. But how much involvement is there? Because when you're talking about the small to medium-sized companies, would you say you need to be involved a lot more and at the early stages to guide them along the way?
Yeah, so this is really done in consultation with the entrepreneurs. Some entrepreneurs will tell us that, you know, things are going well. I'm in charge of my business. I really know what I want to do. But I want you to focus on a few areas. I want you to think about helping me to exit the business eventually, because, you know, maybe the entrepreneur doesn't have a successor, or maybe next step is not that clear to them. Then we will focus on getting the business ready for an IPO, for a trade sale. Some entrepreneurs will tell us that, you know, maybe in Malaysia, their growth is beginning to be saturated and they're looking to us to help them grow into Indonesia, into Vietnam, or Philippines. And then, you know, we would bring to bear our experience in those countries. Where we may not have the experience in specific countries, we will have partners, we will have, you know, investors that can help us in those specific areas. So the value add is very bespoke to the entrepreneurial situation that we find ourselves in. At the very least, we will be involved at the board level. Most of the time, we are also involved at the exco level. And most of the time, we are driving one or two specific projects within the companies.
Okay, and this relationship you have with these companies, they're quite long, right? They can go on for 5 to 10 years. And like all relationships, sometimes it sours. Things can go bad. So what happens in those situations when halfway down, there's a major difference in opinion between how they should be run versus how you think they should be run? What are the options available there for you? Have you had such an encounter?
I think if you have done private equity for 15, 20 years, you know, you would have come across situations where it's not ideal. People do change, circumstances do influence you know, individuals to behave differently. But I think the best way to address is always through dialogue. We do engage very often as we feel the entrepreneur would like us to engage, to find a mutually acceptable solution. Having said that, I think entrepreneurs, when they take institutional money, and private equity is really institutional money, right? They do know these are guys who are responsible for the money that they manage. And therefore, you know, they're not expected to behave in a sukahati kind of way, right? We do have fiduciary duties to report to. So within the fiduciary duties, within trying to protect our interests and investments, we are always, you know, trying to find some kind of common ground.
Okay, and now the all-important exit. Because at the end of the day, if you can't monetize the company, what is the point, right? So let's use the existing Diamond Funds as an example. What's success so far? Because for you, the option is either a listing or a trade sale, right?
As I mentioned, for Diamond Asia Private Equity Fund 1, we have been able to exit 4 of our investments to strategic buyers. We have not done an IPO just yet, but some of our companies are being primed for IPOs. And you know, when we do an exit to strategic buyers, there's actually a lot of work that you need to prepare to make sure it fits the objective of this strategic buyers. So we've been able to exit through trade sale. And that has been quite, I would say, the most common way for a lot of private equity players to exit. I know there's been some that have tried to go down the IPO route as well.
But what about, for example, where, okay, you already bought into the company and you want to do something for the company? And I'll use Yili as an example, because that's been in the press, where you're working with the major shareholders to take the company private. And then subsequently, I don't know, trade sale it or maybe do an IPO a few years down the road. But the minority is the one to buy in. What happens in that case for you all? Are you all stuck?
Well, there are always options. So in the case of Yili, we tried to privatize it with a price that you know, together with our partners, feel is very fair and is reasonable given the premium that we are paying. And minorities can choose not to accept. So we do have to respect the choices that are being made. That doesn't mean we will you know, just stop there. We will continue to look at ways to improve the business. We will continue to look at ways to help all shareholders to realize better value.
Do you see challenges in monetization, though? Because we already see macroeconomic headwinds, right? We have slowing GDP. Won't potential buyers kind of hold back and be more wary?
Yeah, buyers do get influenced by macro factors. But what drives buyers to buy into a business are often more micro considerations. You know, it's your business offering them something that, you know, technically they do not have. It's your business allowing them to cross-sell their products into your market. So oftentimes when the strategic buyers approach us for our businesses, they already know that they want this business. They want this business with this distribution channel, with this specific product, and they have synergies that they can overlay against the valuation that they are prepared to pay. So strategic investors, I would say, are a lot more sophisticated than just you know, responding to macro challenges or macro changes.
So they take a much longer view in terms of what the returns or what the potential of this company can do for them.
Most certainly. I think for strategic investors, they do take that view. A lot of the leaders within these firms are trying to drive transformation or trying to drive change within their firms. You know, take, for example, Japanese buyers. Japanese buyers are looking for growth outside of Japan. And certain markets may remind them of other markets that they were in earlier when they were successful.
Which does always puzzle me, because when you look at the valuations they pay, right? Like, for example, we had, say, Asahi buying Permanis. The valuation they paid on paper looked incredibly expensive. So I always wonder what motivates them. Or is it because in Japan, you're just enjoying these ultra low rates of almost 0%? So it doesn't really matter what kind of returns you can get in Malaysia.
I'm sure cost of capital helps to make the decision easier. You know, if you are having access to cheaper funds, it lowers the bar in terms of, you know, making it easier for you to acquire. But nobody wants to lose money, right, Shaoning? So whenever an investor makes the investment, they would have gone through a lot of strategic board level decision making. And they could be buying a business because not just for the earnings, but for the assets, for the brand, for the distribution channels, for the ability to tap into a new market segment. So there are various reasons why a strategic buyer may look beyond earnings of the business.
And let's talk about listings. I know, Chao-Yun, you said you haven't done any yet, but there's this reputation that companies which have PE funds as major shareholders for IPOs don't usually do well. I mean, we had Leong Hub, which had Affinity Equity Partners. I mean, their current share price now is below IPO. QSR, which didn't even list, which has CVC Partners. There is this sense, and correct me if I'm wrong, that with PE funds as major shareholders, right, the IPO somehow won't be priced well because everyone gets too greedy. Or even assuming post-listing, the share price will languish because the PE fund is always there to provide liquidity because he has to sell down their stake gradually, right? So there is this share overhang. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I think if you were to look at those examples that you cite, then there, you know, will be some merits to that argument. Certainly, private equity, when you have I guess shareholders that are looking to sell out, then, you know, investors, buyers would maybe think that, you know, there could always be a time, a better time to buy, right, when the shareholders want to sell out. So there could be some of that. But I think when you are entering into an investment, at least for us, we always have a specific time frame in mind. But more importantly, we also have specific objectives in mind. So until those objectives are made, until we have, you know, planted our flags in certain countries, until we have expanded the product range, until we have reduced reliance on one customer or one supplier, until we have done that, we would not have considered exit, right? So most of the time when private equity brings a business to the liquidity stage, it's really because certain objectives have already been met.
On that note, Chao-Yun, thank you for your time today to give us some colour on this alternative asset class, which is now an essential part of capital markets. I'm Wong Shaoning for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.